York, London, Paris, Munich, but mostly a seller in Soho. Everybody talk about pop music. My name's Andrew Harrison. Hello and welcome both to our regular listeners and to anyone who has wandered over here from our sister podcast, Romaniacs, because this is a special Crisis on Infinite podcast edition. Crossover, not a dream, not an imaginary story. Joining me and Matt today, we have two of the mainstays of Romaniacs, the best independent anti-Brexit podcast out there.
You would say that, wouldn't
you? I would say that. We would say that. You may have seen him doing the papers on Sky, shouting the odds on LBC, or generally being a pundit about town. Ian Dunt is the editor of politics.co.uk and the author of Brexit, What the Hell Happens Now? But he also knows his big mouth stuff. He was inordinately excited to see Prophets of Rage at the end of last year. And after finishing the Romaniacs recordings, he usually wanders off to spend about 30 quid on comics in Gosh Comics.
You can't give away the number. That's
just welcome to Big Mouth, Ian. How are you?
Thank you very much. Very well indeed. Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to ask you, obviously, you yourself are a suave Adonis, but is politics show business for ugly people, as they say?
Yeah, obviously, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's demonstrably true. You could tell. I mean, they're obsessed with, you know, being with the attention that comes from it, with having all eyes on them, and yet, almost to a man or a woman, they are not like the most gorgeous thing you will ever lay your eyes on.
Has any MP dragged you to see their band? Because there's MP4, isn't there? Are there any other MP bands?
I think there are a couple more sort of bees around the bush. No, I've never, ever, ever seen an MP play any musical instrument at all.
Well, apparently MP4 are okay, if you like that kind of thing. I am waiting for the Rebel MP, Rough Like an Injury Sting, and like a bee at some point. Going to happen. What MPs really are into their pop music? I mean, obviously Stella Creasy loves her kind of C86 wedding present.
Chuka Ramona has quite good taste in music. There's probably some.
Chuka Ramona used to DJ, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. As part of his extensive life before politics, which he increasingly tries not to talk about. And then you're right, the Stella Creasy, of course, got in trouble for going to see Shed 7, not the most
quite
fashionable
right.
band in the world. Yeah. But I like Shed 7. I think Shed's a good meat and potatoes.
She got into trouble. She got into
quite
made up
right.
trouble for going to see Shed 7 with a Tory MP from the kind of bottom inspectors of the Corbynite left. But really, I mean, why shouldn't she go and see Shed 7? That was quite good, apparently, if you like that sort of thing at the moment. Dorian's shaking his head.
I don't care who she goes with, just choose a better band.
What's the matter with Shed 7?
Any band that's got a lead singer whose name has become rhyming slang for toilet, you don't really want to go and see, do you?
Raising the tone ever, as ever. Also with us, you just heard him just then, it's Big Mouth regular and presenter of Romaniacs, Dorian Linsky, who writes for The Guardian, Q and Empire. He's got another book coming out soon. Are you allowed to say what it is?
Not like, that soon.
Got to write it soon.
I've got to write, yes. It's okay. Going to take me some time to write it.
Are you allowed to tell us what it's about?
Yes, it's about Orwell's 1984 and its influences and its gestation and the things that it has influenced.
So 30 pages on Annie Lennox then.
So we go I mean the Eurythmics will be in there, but it sort of goes from
sex
from
crime.
Sort of like the 1880s sort of utopias through to Bowie and the Big Brother house and Steve Jobs.
I like the idea of this because most political journalism just treats popular culture as non-existent. You know, you tend to you get a lot of depth and interest on the politics and the social kind of currents that drive these things, and nobody ever you know, you might get Ghost Town mentioned, you know, or you might get Anarchy in the UK mentioned. Well, that's it, and I'm pleased that you're doing this.
But these are some of the most potent narratives of the sort of last 100 years, these kind of these dystopias, they're constantly coming up. And so you can draw a line from Zamyatin, the Russian novelist in the 20s, to Ayn Rand, to the Lego movie. And it's totally legit. It's basically the same scenario handled differently. Ayn Rand's book is not as funny as the Lego movie. But it's just like it's almost like, I suppose, they're memes. I'm interested in the idea of these kind of dystopian memes and how they manifest in all of these kind of strange places, and particularly with Orwellian language. And that's constantly turning up in all kinds of different TV shows and movies and songs.
I'm intrigued by the idea of Ayn Rand Lego all of a sudden. This week, Ian and Dorian will be helping us to dismantle Britannia, Sky TV's new mega-budget response to Game of Thrones. It's the Druids versus the Romans. Who's going to win? And will you care? Plus, the new third album by psychedelic pop band Django Django. This week's BBC 4 documentary, Hits, Hype and Hustle, which purports to show what really goes on inside the music business. And above all, the stuff they really want to talk about, DC Comics' new series, Doomsday Clock, which attempts to cut and shut the characters from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' classic superhero book, Watchmen, into the mundane world of Batman and the Flash. I think it's an art crime, tantamount to air-texting the Sistine Chapel and the skylights in. But what are my fellow comics nerds Ian and Dorian and Matt Hall, the Klaus Janson of podcasts, What do they think about it? Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Jolly good.
Okay. Is that an Orwell term? Art crime.
Art crime.
That was the 19. B-side of the Eurythmics single.
Yeah.
I'd just like to point out, it is freaking me out that you two are by microphones right now. So whenever we do Romaniacs, you don't get to talk like in the proper recording talk. Now,
do you not like it? Like,
it's very weird.
Take your son to work day. Or
yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it feels like.
Yeah, do we just hover and scowl, don't we? Just make like people in the technical area, the football, Dorian and Ian are now going blank face. Like,
are you Sammy Lee?
Absolutely, yeah. Anyway, before we start, a little word about Big Mouth. We've been running the podcast for nearly 2 years now, and it is fantastic fun. We've got loyal listeners who spread the word, and we get great feedback on every show. But unfortunately, that doesn't pay the rent. We've been meeting our studio bills and expenses out of our pockets so far, and unfortunately, that can't go on forever. So we are asking for your support in the simplest way via the crowdfunding platform Patreon. It's nothing complicated. We're not doing T-shirts or hats or branded egg cups or anything like that. We're just saying, if you enjoy Big Mouth once a month, will you buy us a pint? Not an actual pint, but just the equivalent of £5 a month via Patreon. Patreon works in dollars for some reason, so that's going to be $7.
That's a London pint.
That's a London pint. Well, we are in London. Yeah, we are in London. If we can get to a guaranteed £600 a month, we'll be able to cover our studio and production costs and keep Big Mouth going. So that's only 120 listeners donating $7 a month. And of course, if you want to donate more and maybe buy us two virtual pints and a packet of virtual kettle chips, then that would be extremely welcome. If we can reach our £600 a month goal, we'll start recording an extra segment of the show for Patreons only. Have a look at patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. All we are saying is buy us a pint. Anyway, shall we get started? Britannia is Sky's bid to create their own Game of Thrones, a lavish, visually stunning epic of war, rivalry, backstabbing, front stabbing, whatever you like, but no dragons. It stars David Morrissey as hard-faced Roman General Aulus, Zoe Wanamaker as a queen of a tribe of Britons, Mackenzie Crook as a genuinely disturbing druid, and a load of people you've never heard of as everybody else. Whatever you make of it, we're going to have a taster first.
Before the gods, there was nothing but chaos.
Gods.
Demons.
We've invaded hell.
So what's the mission?
The Romans are devils. We must send them home.
I bet the Romans are lying awake right now, shaking.
Fall!
You have no power, not anymore.
The gods have a fate for all of us. Find yours.
You're on your own. You have to go through Little Demon Wood, then east.
Wait, no, hold on. Little Demon Wood.
It's the wood that's little, not the demon. Safe journey.
Rome, if you want to. Britannia on Sky there. Dorian Lynskey, what did you make of this sprawling epic of druidical carrying on?
Well, it's like a mess. But is it a good mess or a bad mess?
Or
because
a hot mess?
It was being pitched as kind of punk to Game of Thrones prog rock, but it's sort of more psychedelic. Obviously, it starts off with Donovan's hurdy gurdy man. There's lots of like you know, weirdiness. There's the people taking hallucinogens, and it's got that kind of. It's almost like what if the characters from co-written by Jez Butterworth, and it's like what of these kind of acid guzzling wasters from his play Jerusalem decided to do Roman Britain with like one Wikipedia page to work from and then just filling in the gaps with kind of, you know, the magic druids and so on. So it was like I was left very unsure by the end. And I also thought that if there are going to be Game of Thrones comparisons, do not set up in the very first episode a kind of tetchy rom-commy love-hate relationship between somebody quite like the Hound and somebody quite like Arya.
Yes, there is that. Also, be wary of having a dodgy kind of marital relationship somewhere within one of the kingdoms. Because a lot of the first episode is basically let's tour all the locations and see where we are and see who hates whom, and then we'll work it from there. We've got Julian Ryan Tutt as the playing the scion of a British tribe, very much in the style of. A minor member of a landed gentry family.
Well, he seems to be told that it's a sitcom. And nobody else has been told it's a sitcom.
Why don't they just go the whole hand and go, like, call him Hengist Pod from Carry On Cleo? Because that's exactly basically what the kind of, the way that he was playing it was some kind of
posh
slightly
Hengist
camp.
Pod. Yeah.
Wait, which one? Is this the guy from Green Wing?
Yeah.
I mean, he was the worst thing about it. And there was a lot of bad things going on there, and he was by some distance because he was still in fucking Green Wing.
Yeah.
Can I swear on this one?
Yeah.
Great. I mean, he was still, you're exactly, all of it was just comic timing, completely like you could have, if you just put a jacket on him, he would have just been a guy in London. That's where he was. Mm. So when they filled it with all the other sort of accoutrements of the druid stuff and everything seemed a bit alien, you know, there's a girl being fed drugs and her parents going to cut her belly, and they'd shown some commitment to the weirdness of the past. Mm. Then to just have this slice of Green Wing just come in and just start making sort of punchline jokes about, oh, you're about to get married, mate, be the last day of your life. And you think like that is completely out of place. It was struggling anyway. When he came in, the whole thing just detonated.
Well, I actually quite enjoyed it and was able to sort of... I liked the fact that there's a lot of modern idiom conversation, but the beliefs behind them are very much of the time. So, you know, you've got people talking in a modern-day English because I think, you know, drama is completely over the hump of having people in the past talk with "Arr, 'tis a witch upon the hill, sire," type of thing. You know, we're through that. But when you look, the glimpses into the interior life of General Arliss, played by David Morrissey, you know, very much his voice is very much of a contemporary guy, but his beliefs are of a man who's gone into the underworld. This is a terrifying, you know, hellish, mystic land, and he transmits that, and also his kind of
should we just point out that although it's kind of like quite an interesting thing, although they're transmitting it weekly on Sky Arts, it's actually all the episodes are now up there on Now TV, so we've probably all watched different. I've watched two, and that's where he goes into the underworld in the kind of second episode.
I just saw the first one. I wasn't going to see any more of that. I'm actually very fascinated in this period with the sort of the pre-Roman British period. I think that's just really, really interesting. That comes an awful lot. I mean, actually, so you just, which is, you know, Slain the Horned God, which is this whole 2000 AD strip by Pat Mills.
And
incredible piece of work. Well, no, but that very, very, when I was very young, I read that. And what I remembered was that it was fundamentally amoral. It fundamentally reflected a completely different moral world to the one that I knew. There was no sense of that there would be a happy ending in any moral way, or even a bad ending. It was just alien.
Yeah.
And that seemed like I wanted more of that, and it felt like there were little lingering bits of that. It felt like they hadn't run away from that idea, and yet it was just produced. I don't think the problem was really in the script. I think it was in the production and the acting. It was produced like classic British drama. So the acting was very, this was sort of Tetley's paganism, really. You know, it was all quite like reassuring Yorkshire accents and off you go, and delivered as if it was really, you know, an episode of Corrie or something. And yet the content was very different. And that didn't feel to me like a purposeful decision. That felt like sort of losing your confidence at the last moment and actually quite jarring.
So, Dorian, I was just going to say, I've never seen any Jez Butterworth. He's never written any kind of TV before, has he?
He's written movies.
Has he? But I mean, TV. Is this his usual shtick, this kind of...
No, he's written, I mean, he kind of wrote a movie about a biopic of James Brown. I mean, he's got lots of different things that he can do. But in Jerusalem, it's a fascinating look at the kind of that sort of... It's kind of around these characters who are kind of travellers and the sort of tense relationship with the people who live in the village. I mean, it's amazing, but there's a lot of kind of sort of paganism and psychedelic aspects mixed with this real kind of earthiness. But what it does is it kind of becomes richer, that play, which is astonishing. It becomes richer as it goes on, as indeed as his latest one, The Ferryman. Whereas this seemed to suffer from like pilotitis, which just throws everything at you. And so it's just kind of, there's no time. The character journey, that poor old, that legionnaire,
who starts off
having to slit people's throats and then ends up kind of possessed by the underworld in like an hour, during which time you have no understanding of who this guy is. And I'm thinking the first Game of Thrones, it said there's a lot of shit going to happen, but it didn't make all the shit happen in the first hour.
Yeah.
It kind of built up and it deepened and it got richer. And with this, it just seemed like, Jesus, have some confidence in yourself that you can tease the fact that, you know, more things in heaven and earth that, you know, than you dreamt of in your philosophy. It just kind of like hint at that. Don't go straight into possession and druid sacrifice and psychedelic happenings.
I quite liked the fact that our people, you know, the people we are supposed to identify with, the native Britons, are a lot stranger and, as Ian says, more amoral and more, you know, inscrutable and unknowable than the straightforward Romans. The Romans are more like modern-day us, aren't they? And I like the fact that it didn't just go for a straightforward, tedious morality play about the simple peasant people being invaded by the appalling imperialist, you know, kind of Roman straight-line thought, as Julian Cope would complain about. I quite liked that. But I did wonder whether it suffered from the fact that the entire look of the whole thing, firstly, it's going to be seen to be wanting next to Game of Thrones, but secondly, all of these costumes, all of these outfits, they've all been seen in a Florence Machine video. They've all been seen in a Fairport Convention
artwork. But they had, to be fair, they have spent an awful lot of money. Like the CGI, like when the Roman ships sail across the channel, and there's a lot of them. You know, they spent a lot of money on that. Or they did do it at night, so they didn't have to do too much detail on the kind of ships and stuff. And then there's the big kind of British tribes. One of them has got this kind of mountaintop fortress, which is quite an impressive bit of. They have spent quite a lot of money on it.
Well, I just go back to my bugbear on this show, which is that incredible spectacle no longer matters. Incredible spectacle, right's white. Everything does incredible spectacle now. What is really hard to do is characters that are as alive as the Hound or as alive as Arya Stark, which I don't think this has got. I think the characters.
Yeah, but you can't.
The only one that really stands out.
Playing devil's advocate, can you say after kind of one 60-70 minute episode, this character, you know, the Hound and Arya Stark had kind of like, has had like eight series and seasons.
And
to
I think
develop.
There's a lot. I did like it, and I think there's a lot of potential. I think Mackenzie Crook is very compelling. I think there's a lot of potential in the kind of acid damaged Welsh outcast who looks like Thor, staggering around trying to bring down the Roman Empire on his own. There's a lot of potential there. Not so thrilled by Julian Ryan Tutt's character. Zoe Wanamaker, who knows? She's on, she's off. But I think that there's a lot of potential as well in David Morrissey's General Arliss, because he is clearly going to be the proxy for the entire Roman Empire confronting the unknown.
And I'm quite excited about the fact that they've chosen the kind of Ninth Legion, which is famously the one that disappeared somewhere up in the kind of in the wilds of Pictish Scotland. So, you know, they've got a whole lot. I mean, I'd go back to what, you know, Ian was saying earlier, but actually nobody really knows what happened in this period of kind of British history. And actually the only people that we've got, the only written records of it are from the Roman historians, who all went, it's fucking nuts over there. There are people with kind of heads in their bellies, and you know.
But you can. The maddening thing about it is that I had really high hopes, and you could tell that there is so much going on, like what kind of rich material to play with. And there are kind of flashes of that. But there didn't seem to be any time spent. There wasn't great, compelling character work, which even in episode one of Game of Thrones, there was some wonderful dialogue. You were instantly fascinated by certain characters. And I just, you can already sense it being something where the idea has got away from it, them in some way. And that it just seems like there's, is it going to find those spaces where things actually become genuinely interesting and moving? Or is it just going to be someone going, ooh, like, you know, when you're doing like mushrooms around a campfire and someone like waving their hands in front of your face to freak you out?
It is a slightly leveler's element to it, yes.
There were a couple of moments of conviction, and both involved people that you've mentioned. I mean, the first one was that sort of weird druid guy with the terrible teeth who's always, you know, having the dreams, where he sort of plays some mind game on another tribe. And that bit, for a moment, you're like, oh, that's actually flickered and come alive a little bit. Yeah. And again with the centurion, where he talks about this magic trick that he's seen in Egypt with the swapping over of the chicken's heads.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where he's sort of lost in the memory of something that got him. And there was another moment of conviction there. You went, oh, that was another high point. The rest of it, I have to say, for each moment that you looked at it, you just thought, I don't believe for a second that any of this is taking place. Whereas, yes, in Game of Thrones, no matter how many dragons there are or whatever else, you do actually believe that that is taking place. Well, the other comparison, of course, to me would be Apocalypto, you know, fundamentally underrated sort of Mel Gibson film, which again takes this very old alien culture and just properly makes you believe that it's taking place in a very visceral way. I didn't feel any of that, apart from these little flickering moments that might give some hope for the future.
So overall, it's like, Ian doesn't really like it at all. I'm going to stick with it, I think. Would we rather they just made Slain? We'd run that, wouldn't we?
It's not that. I think they would have made the same mistakes with Slain as that, which is a fundamental lack of confidence when you get to the last moment.
Okay. All right, let's have some music, shall we? We always ask our guests to bring a tune in, an editor's recommendation in the style of the Britannia Haha Music Club. Ian Dunt, what have you brought in for us?
Oh, right, yes, it's St. Vincent, and it's, what is it? It's Los Angeles, is that how you say it?
Yes, it is. And why have you chosen this?
So this is from a new album. I'm sort of fascinated by her, really. She's one of those people that it seems like anything you say about her, the opposite is also true. So she's sort of sultry, but then just fucking cold, like bone deep cold at the same time. And she's sort of vulnerable, but very, very strong and quite sort of distant. But at the same time, she sort of puts herself out there. And this song is a really good example of that. The chorus is a sort of three stage element to it, which is a form of storytelling of, you know, how could anybody have you? How could anyone have you and lose you? And then how could anybody have you and lose you and not lose your mind? Where the structure even of the way that that's said gives an impression of what it is like to sort of, you know, to be infatuated with someone where the power dynamic is not in your favor, and the way that you're being tugged along as an audience. I think she is remains just this extraordinary, extraordinary sort of musician. And this is typical of her talents.
Okay, don't go into music journalism, Ian. There is no money in it. That's very adroit. There is no money in it. Stay.
I've seen how Dorian dresses, man. I mean, there's no fucking way I'm going
to... Stay in your lucrative lane, Ian. This is Los Angeles by Saint. Ageless by St. Vincent, as chosen by our guest Ian Dunt of the Romaniacs podcast. So, more music. Django Django were slightly a cut above the indie pop usual when they arrived with their handmade in Dalston psychedelic pop in 2012. Time isn't often kind to the new bands. Is their new album, third album, Marble Skies, out this Friday, up to the job of keeping a fickle world interested? We're going to have a taste from Marble Skies. This is King of Beat. Django Django with In Your Beat from the new album Marble Skies. Dorian Linsky, do you like Django Django?
I do. I particularly liked their second album, whose title completely eludes me.
Saturn.
Born Under Saturn, I believe.
Yeah, and it's and I thought it's fantastic because they're one of those bands that I actually find really hard to write about, because they're in this sort of tradition where they're doing so many different things at once and they're merging so many influences, and that can sometimes leave me cold, like everything. Who was sort of similarly eclectic, and I just find them grating. Whereas Django Django, they managed to kind of hop between all these different sort of elements, and they're not doing, oh, now it's this song, now we're doing like a reggae song, and now's a country song. They're all kind of like woven in. I think they've got it's all held together by this very distinctive vocal. And I mean, on this, I don't know whether I like it as much as the last one. The stuff where it really took off for me was when it gets really dancey, like In Your Beat, Real Gone. That seems to be the side that works best. I think the songwriting was actually a little bit stronger before.
I'm kind of a sucker for when bands go, you know what, sod it, let's get the synths in and go dance, you know, in pretty much like, I think the Horrors did that at the end of last year, didn't they? We're going to like bring in the synths and dance it up. I think I enjoyed this more than the previous records. It is basically, you know, a lot of things are house music with cheap synths, and I was expecting, you know, somebody like MC Lethal to pop up in the middle of that track we just played there, because it had that wobbly 1993 warehouse sound to it. You know, Ian, what did you think of it? Is this your cup of tea?
I wouldn't have thought so, but I really enjoyed it. I'd never heard of them before. I'd never heard any of the other albums. I found this quite blissed out and really just genuinely quite a lovely thing to have on. I didn't think that it was particularly breaking any new ground, but I do feel that I was constantly surprised by the places that it kept on ending up in. And I thoroughly enjoy myself. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that it wouldn't turn me into someone who's going to start talking about this with everyone that I met, but I enjoyed every second of it that I listened to, and I found that I kept on listening to it even when I didn't need to.
You'd be pressing it on people in the kind of Brexit Select Committee and saying, you really need to get into this.
Exactly. No, I think that's the real message that those guys need above any other.
But they do have, I mean, you mentioned the kind of like synths and stuff. They have, I'm a real fan of theirs, and they do have, on the other two albums, a dance kind
There's
of
always
theme
been a dance element
it.
To their music, is that
and
what you're
saying? And, you know, I got into them because there was a kind of Beta Band connection, and I think one of them is related to one of the guys from the Beta Band, and he produced a few of the first of the tracks on the first album. But they've taken that Beta Band thing, which are those kind of interesting rhythms, and as Dorian mentioned, kind of slightly the way of kind of approaching vocals, where some of it's kind of just a line repeated again and again, and it's quite kind of hypnotic and trancy and stuff. But then they've kind of taken it on, and it's gone more kind of synthy and more dance orientated, and I'd just say that if you follow them on Twitter, the Django's official thing, it's really interesting because they all post basically link to loads of kind of like YouTube videos of kind of really dark kind of Four Aces drum and bass from like 1993 and stuff. It's brilliant. They're obviously really into that.
They have fantastic taste. There's a Late Night Tales compilation on there, which is just incredible. Every song. And they're good at finding the weird song by a band that you don't think of that weird. There's one by like Canned Heat, which I became obsessed with because it's a really weird Canned Heat song about the moon. It's like a krautrock song about the moon. And they're just one of those bands with sort of fantastic taste and a kind of ease with moving in and out of genres. And I don't know, they always just seem like, they just are like nice people. It's a very, like Ian said, it's like a very benign sounding record, you know. And I don't know whether the hooks are going to stick with me, but there's just a kind of sense of well-being.
It's just a nice experience, isn't it? I mean, they've got a very good way of bringing together that kind of you know, sort of floating contemporary psychedelia that you know would hear in, you know, Temples or Time and Space Machine, one of the obsessions of the show, and connecting it with proper bangers, but also being able, Matt banned the word banger. proper dance bits. I like this better because I think the previous albums have made a kind of a point of the ramshackle nature of the band. You know, they've made it into a benefit that this thing seems to be falling apart at the edges. I like the fact that this has been tightened up a lot and that it seems to be able to range in a single song from sounding like a kind of 1994 Eat Static track to sounding like Mercury Rev, or, you know, sounding like even a, you know, sort of pastoral folky thing. I was strongly reminded of Julian Cope on this one, actually, and particularly like his St. Julian time. There's even a track called Sundials.
But I'm kind of reminded of, I always think that they came out of the kind of Edinburgh art school scene, the same one that kind of birthed Franz Ferdinand. And I kind of think they're as clever as Franz Ferdinand, but I don't know why they've never made that kind of leap. Because actually, interestingly enough, the copy that we got sent had a instrumental album, all the tracks with the kind of vocals taken off. And they have their biggest hits have been off kind of computer games and stuff, where they've had like instrumental tracks chucked onto kind of a FIFA track and stuff like that. And I kind of think, is it because they don't have an Alex Capranos in their midst who's going to go be kind of nice media bloke?
They don't have a front man. They're not great at interviews. They're amazing live.
Yeah, live they're absolutely. I saw them at the top stage at Glastonbury a few years ago.
I think they're one of those bands
that incredible.
That everyone see, if you see them at a festival, you're just like, oh, I love this band now. Yeah. I just don't think they're going to be one of those bands where they have the big moment, the big song that breaks them.
Well, that's actually part of it, isn't it? They don't really have a frontman, but neither that, you know, the songs don't sort of focus in the thing that they're trying to communicate. They sound amazing. They sound like tremendous fun, but you never come away from it thinking that's what this song was about. You know, there's a lot of the kind of non-specific contemporary lyric writing where it's about conveying a vibe rather than the way that Franz Ferdinand were extremely traditional in that, you know, you knew what this song was about.
My pet theory at the moment, sorry, just to slot this in, is that I think that we need to think again generally about, music journalists need to, about what we mean by breaking through and mainstream. Because I've seen people like, say, the Last Horrors record, the Last St. Vincent record, critics going, this could be the big one. It doesn't work like that. The charts are complete. Top 40 is completely alien to this kind of music now. Yeah. It's completely walled off to this kind of stuff. And it's like, how do you define big? You know, and there's people that you've never heard of a song by, but you see they're headlining Ali Pali.
Yeah.
It's like, and different people, they're kind of trying to reach different levels. So the idea of going, even as recent as Franz Ferdinand, where you could go, right, they would have a top 10 single and then that would break them and then they would go and do Britain's Academy. I don't think that's the path for most bands now. It's not the path for the Horrors. It's not the path for Django Django.
Maybe
it's,
it is getting a track on a soundtrack to a... Yeah.
It's soundtracks video and it's festivals
game,
and it's just becoming like, you know, just sort of weaving their way into people's lives in lots of interesting ways. But then they're never going to be like ready for the big time with a photo of them with their heads through the Hollywood sign. It's just the game has changed.
We could talk about that a little bit later in the show when we discuss Hits, Hype and Hustle on BBC4, which is about, you know, exactly this, making your band big. And then you're watching it thinking, what does big mean anymore? But before that, Dorian, should we have your choice of tune? What have you brought in for us?
I brought in Flashing Lights by Lord Such, of Monster Raving Loony fame.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never actually listened to his music before because I just thought he was a kind of, you know, great British eccentric whose music was probably bad. And this is from an album that he made, released in 1970, and it's got It's co-written with Jimmy Page, this song. And Jimmy Page then just crapped all over it in the press, basically, and disowned it and got, I don't know why I did that. And I discovered it because it's on the closing credits of Logan Lucky, which is a hugely entertaining heist movie. Mm. And it's directed by Steven Soderbergh and therefore soundtracked by David Holmes. And I think he is the king of sort of, it's sort of like mainstream crate digging. All his compilations introduce me to sort of wonderful stuff, but you can also do it on a huge platform. So with Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 12, he discovered Little Less Conversation, this obscure Elvis track, which ends up becoming a number one single and probably what the Elvis song that like most people under a certain age know.
Yeah.
And I thought there was something thrilling about this, everybody leaving the cinema from this movie that did pretty well, kind of listening to this brilliant kind of like heavy freak beat track by Lord Such and going, what's that?
Yeah.
And I love that reaction, and I love being introduced to songs, old songs, through movies and TV. And I think David Holmes is the master.
Well, if Lord Such was still around, he'd probably be up to lead UKIP next, wouldn't he? I believe there's a vacancy. This is Lord Such, the artist formerly known as Screaming Lord Such, with Flashing Lights. That was Lord Such with Flashing Lights, as chosen by Doreen Linsky. And Ian Dunt of politics.co.uk was just saying he never realised that Lord Such did music at all.
I just thought he was, like you said, I just thought he was this British eccentric, turned up at, you know, counts, voting counts and polling stations, and that was about it. I didn't know there was any musical background.
You never even heard Nigel Farage's Scar stuff. Yeah. Come on, Ian, where have you been?
Yeah, the immense slackness in Farage's Scar stuff.
Farage Moonstop. He was so judged.
His own version of Scar, which was called One Tone.
Yes. And on that bombshell, anyway, we're going to move on. There's an apparently inexhaustible appetite for music documentaries on BBC Four. This week's entry is Hits, Hype and Hustle, which purports to tell us exactly how the music business evolved into the thing that it is today. Episode one gave us music agent Emma Banks discussing the making of stars with guests including Perry Farrell, Blur and Frank Butcher lookalike Clive Davis. Now, Dorian, you were not very impressed with this. I'm going to ask Ian first. What did you think? Did you...
So I enjoyed bits of this, and it started dabbling in an area that I find really interesting, which is, you know, the extent to which music, and music is the stuff that gets this foot on in the face more than any other art form, is really about the creativity or is about sort of the industry side of things.
Yeah.
It made a very major mistake, I think, of...
Well, it had Perry Farrell in it.
It was actually, it's the presenter should have been a talking head.
Yeah.
And at the point where she becomes a talking head and she starts talking about what it was like during Britpop when it was male dominated and everyone's drinking, she becomes interesting.
Yeah.
For the rest of it, she's not interesting. She seems like she's constantly trying to justify her presence there.
We always complain, this bloody documentary is fronted by Lauren Laverne or Phil Jupiter. Now we know why.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it desperately needed a music journalist there. Someone who was basically going to go, well, look, on the one hand, it's required. This is how this stuff operates. But on the other hand, there's something about creativity there. Now, there was a point where, and I don't think I'm particularly naive in the way that, but when she starts saying that basically Jeff Buckley made it because I booked him into a tiny club somewhere, I was just like, no, fuck you.
To be fair to her,
you know what? The anodyne stuff that she was saying, she didn't come up with that. You know, the vast majority of that stuff was on kind of voiceover, which somebody had given her a script to kind of sit in front of a microphone and read. You know, that is...
I would take that on point. I guess my problem is this, is that I understand that ultimately this stuff is a product. I understand the guys have to look a certain way and present a certain way, and there's a logistics behind it to how that should operate. There was a sense in that program that really there wasn't much else that was really going on here. And it's sort of typified, by the way, the guy from Menswear in the end said, it's a can of beans. Now, you know, pop song is a can of beans, a band is a can of beans. But what's interesting to me is no one ever says that about books. No one ever says that about movies, even though these things are obviously being produced in a capitalist society where they're being paid for in some way. I mean, that's, of course, we understand the dynamics. Everything has a price in that way. But that doesn't mean that it's a can of beans and that there's nothing else involved in it. And it sort of shifted itself into a very weird place. And I think the reason for that was picking the presenter who really needed to be part of the conversation, but not hosting the conversation.
But my problem with it was that it... I found a lot of it interesting, actually. I'm a lot closer to this kind of stuff than you are, but I found new things in it. What I found kind of annoying was the idea that it was presenting, this is the way to do it. This is the way. We've cracked it. We've cracked the code. In the 1960s, you sent the Supremes and Martha and the Vandellas to a deportment person, and they learned how to get out of a car in a ladylike manner. Then, in the 1970s, you dressed them up to look like a spaceman. This is the way to do it. We've cracked it. And you had appearances. But what I really liked was the appearances by John Niven, ex of this podcast, who poked holes in all of this and basically said nobody really knows anything. This is, a lot of what is presented as science in the production, management, and presentation of artists. You hear about the one time it went right. You don't hear about the thousand times it went wrong. Dorian, you were not a fan of this show, were you?
I thought it was garbage. I thought it just typified the desperate lack of ambition that you find in most music documentaries on BBC Four.
Don't sit on the fence, Dorian. I mean, just, say what you think.
It's just no, but it's so disappointing because we've all seen like the good ones. I always hold up like Synth Britannia as just this masterclass in telling a story beautifully with music and visuals and interviews and voiceover. This had no narrative. Mm. It had no storytelling. It just was like, here's some stuff. It was like if I wrote a feature like that and I just went, yeah, so we start off, so we've got Motown, but then I'm talking to Perry Farrell.
Lady Lisher.
A bit on Blur, then a bit on Lady Lisher. And it was just like, what? So you're grouping this, right, into, so there's just going to be like one bit about, styling, how they look, and one bit about A&R in terms of influencing songwriting. No, it's just going to be a kind of stream of consciousness flinging interviewees at you with no sense of, completely decontextualized, no sense of history, no sense of a kind of an argument being made. So the only pleasure I could get out of it was just tiny clips, particular appearances. I thought like Moni Love.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who just looks amazing.
She's fantastic. Yeah. And she's kept her accent.
And she just, the joy in which she's explaining. And I have no idea really what relevance this has to the general, thrust of it.
She was talking about how she appeared on De La Soul's Buddy, and she just kept on going, and Pos de Nous A&R'd me. He put me on the record.
And that was great. And so that should have been set up by going, A&R can take many different forms. The producer can perhaps do the job. Another fellow artist can be A&R.
Also, there was that bit where they had Dame Dash, who famously, they're putting him up as a kind of like hip-hop genius, who famously completely destroyed his relationship with Jay-Z and is now literally can't get arrested, which for a black man in America is kind of some sort of achievement. But then they talked to Matty C, who's a kind of hip-hop journalist, who said, and basically people realised that, the labels realised that hip-hop artists were the best A&Rs. So if they got somebody on the record, then they just basically give them a label and they could kind of get somebody. And it's like, no, that's why hip-hop had such a dearth of crap music being released over the last 20 years, because people are just giving their mates records.
Yeah,
but what was the structure of it? What was the argument? I mean, if you think about how good documentaries are made outside the world of music, they will take a representative story. I'm not saying everything should be like Adam Curtis or something, but
but
you take a story
wrong.
And you go, but they were. But everybody thinks A&R is like this, but they were wrong
in white tie.
And then there's a
background.
Picture of like someone like shaking. Some of the State Department shaking hands with Assad, or someone from Menswear's in the background. But it would just like to go, okay, let's take a story. There were these great stories. The Menswear story was really interesting about, they wouldn't sign to Rough Trade because they wouldn't buy them expensive
loads.
The Blur thing, I always love the story of how basically Damon was just told to go off and write some hits for Modern Life is Rubbish. There's all these good stories. Structure them. Do something. Have a proper presenter. Introduced to people at different points, so you go, okay, I'm absorbing the story of X. Instead, if they were just like, here you go, it's Clive Davis. Oh, and now's Moni Love. And here's Perry Farrell again. And you're just like, what the hell do you even think you were doing in the editing suite? Like, how long did you have? Like, an afternoon to put this together? It offended me.
Clearly did. It's high dudgeon.
But also, and I might need to take this bit out, but didn't they get things factually wrong? Like Mike Smith is not just an A&R manager. Mike Smith runs one of the big kind of three labels in the UK. And they were just kind of like, they just said, introduced him as someone, and just, it was like a throwaway thing. It's like, why would, surely you've checked that stuff.
I don't know. Well, I mean, often things kind of get signed off before people get promoted. But Mike Smith's been doing that job for ages.
For
ages. I think I generally sort of enjoyed the bits that I enjoyed the bits that were enjoyable. I did like Matt Everett fessing up to the terrible errors that that Menswear made early on,
the bit where Mike Smith got admitted getting his mates to go up and sign in on the guest list at a Menswear gig as other A&R guys so that they couldn't then get in to see
that
the band.
That was good chat.
Yeah, but for all that, the fact that it essentially regurgitated all the cliches that we already know this about the world of A&R and promotion and image manufacture, don't we? It is in itself a cliche. Movies have been made around this cliche, and I don't really know that we get an awful lot out of having it.
But it's completely ahistorical. If you're not going to have any kind of chronological narrative of an argument about how things change, you can't ram the early days of Motown together with Britpop and then the rise of Jay-Z and go, it's all just A&R. It's nonsense.
The conclusion, such as it was, is that, and here we are in a loft in Shoreditch where a lot of young people sitting around laptops, and A&R and music promotion has become another branch of data processing just like everything else. Which to me seems to be both true and boring. Things that are true have no obligation to be interesting and exciting, but it's the job of projects like this to find some way of making them exciting.
I don't think that's even true. I think that's a horribly sort of depressing, declinist narrative, which doesn't reflect the way that most artists work.
But it reflects the way that most record labels work, because the way that all promotion has been piled into management of digital promotion, and you saw them sitting there looking at a projection with, oh, look at all the millions of Facebook likes we've got, in itself an immensely debatable thing to base your career on. But the industry believes it and acts that way.
Well, that would be the story, isn't it? Surely that's that. There's quite an interesting documentary to be made.
That's where you want Adam Curtis to probably say, but they were wrong.
Buying SoundCloud plays off the shelf and getting boosting their kind of profile and stuff. That's the interesting story. Mm. And being, playing the labels for suckers, wasn't that.
I think it kind of regurgitated the idea that the kind of cowlization of pop is complete and we've cracked the code and we've cracked the formula and therefore it will always work forever. Such as there was a narrative in the program at all, it showed you that over and over again the formula failed and didn't work.
It's absolute nonsense. Who's the biggest pop star in the world right now? It's Ed Sheeran.
Yeah,
and his story. He's got none of the kind of traditional sort of components where you just go, you're going right the way to the top.
Yeah, snaps Kit Kat.
There's a lot of kind of good luck and chance encounters and hard work. And to just go, oh, well, back in the day, it was this or that. The idea that it's less controlled now, that it's more sort of controlled and more data-driven. The early days of Motown, where it's literally, you cannot say these words, you can only wear these clothes, you cannot have your hair in a natural afro. Yeah. Like, there is nothing more controlled than the early days of Motown.
And brilliantly, you have to walk from your buttocks.
Yeah. That was amazing. I absolutely love that. That was extraordinary.
I always work from my butthole.
I mean, my impression is that there is a far more attempt to impose control at that data end of things, and it doesn't work. And yet people are still doing it. They've gone all in on you can use big data to crack the code and make it work, but it's not working.
Well, hopefully they'll all listen to this podcast and realise their mistake.
Absolutely. Let's move on and talk about, that's by the way, Hits, Hype and Hustle, which Dorian is figuratively punching right now. You can hear it in the background there. It's available on iPlayer now if you want to have a look and see what you think yourself.
I mean, I've been watching you get angry about Brexit for 9 months and I've never seen you as angry as you are.
He's treating this documentary the way he usually treats Liam Fox and David Davis.
Just deserve better.
Time to move on and to talk about what our guests really want to talk about, which is comic books. If you don't read comics, A, why? And B, you will not be aware of the existence of the event series. This is a blockbuster special event where the comics companies jam multiple characters into epic storylines where worlds are destroyed and lives are changed forever until the next one. So far, so comic book guy from The Simpsons. But one arrived this month that has really got people's backs up. DC's new series, Doomsday Clock, is designed to shoehorn the characters from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen series into the world of Superman, Wonder Woman and The Flash. For some, it's great fun and it's only comics, so stop complaining about it. For others, it is an act of vandalism against one of the few comics that can genuinely be called a work of great literature. And it's another insult from mainstream comics to Alan Moore, who feels so successfully swindled and aggrieved that he no longer allows his name to be used on reprints of his past work. What do we think? We're going to talk about this after What Else? Pop Will Eat Itself, and Can You Dig It? Alan Moore knows the score.
Terminator, hit the north. Alan Moore knows the score. rich. Yeah. Can you dig it?
Itself and can you dig it? Now, Watchmen is one of very few superhero stories that mainstream readers will know because it deals with archetypes. And now DC have decided to make a sequel to it, a sequel to a perfect piece of work. Why have they done this? Ian Dunst, Doomsday Clock, what's going on here?
I mean, there's so many bits to unravel here, really. I mean, there's a moral argument, which is the one that's really used against
Alan
Moore.
Tell us the story first before you start telling us the moral argument. What is happening in Doomsday Clock?
Okay, so what's the actual content of it? So Watchmen was set, you know, even I think in the time of this thing, a few years back, it's a depiction of a very, very cynical, seedy universe where all superheroes are, as Alan Moore believed they would be in the real world, basically sort of sexually impotent fascists. Mm-hmm. That world has existed for some time. At the end of that book, spoilers now if you haven't read this book that came out in 1988 or 1986 or whatever it was, a guy called Ozymandias, this sounds so much sillier than it is depicted in the actual thing, conspires using some artists, some writers, and some scientists to drop what looks like a massive alien on New York with a sort of big sort of telepathic attack, kills millions of people, all designed to get America and Russia to work together so that they don't kill each other.
Scared straight is what they believe.
Quite, yeah. No, so that doesn't work out, mostly because Rorschach, a character, a very, very interesting character in that book, who's completely broken but has a very, very right-wing, but has a series of, you know, unmovable moral principles, sends off a letter before he is killed. So everyone finds out what it is from the newspaper. The world is falling apart. Now it seems that Ozymandias and a new Rorschach, this is in the first issue now of what is it?
Doomsday Clock.
I always want to call it Disaster Cock, and I don't know why. Like, it's been
more
every time
appropriate.
I've talked
it
about
is a disaster cock.
I can understand that. Anyway, they've now decided they need to go find Dr. Manhattan, super powerful being. He is hiding, we think, in the DC universe. So there they go. They break the membrane, and now they're with the rest of the superheroes.
Sounds great.
Dorian has his head in
what
his
do you
hands.
Think? What did you think about this?
It's like an atrocity. Yeah. Almost
like... Is it better or worse than Hit's Hypernuzzle?
It's kind of more conceptually offensive. Yeah. Like Hit's Hypernuzzle was just incompetent, whereas this is like rotten to the core. I don't really mind. Alan Moore has been like moaning about his, you know, relationship with DC for so long now. It's just like, you know, whatever. It's
whatever,
just
Al.
Whatever. You know, it's like that's the copyright situation. I don't really, that doesn't bother me. But what they've done to the story, the ending was perfect. It was kind of like, you needed that sort of ambiguity. Is this plan going to work? What will happen if Rorschach's revelations are published?
Yeah. It's like if a superhuman decided to put the world to rights, A, is that morally defensible? And B, could it hold?
Let you, the reader, decide. And then within like the first two pages of this, it's like, no, you, the reader, can't decide. This is what's happened. Mm. They introduce, because they're so spineless, just a new Rorschach who just talks exactly like the old Rorschach because the old Rorschach's dead. Mm. So I suppose he didn't die in a dream, but they've basically just got another one. And then what I didn't realise, because I hadn't read any of the press about this, was that they were going to merge universes. And literally, I was reading it, and then Superman appears, and I was like, fuck off. Yeah. I could not fucking believe it. Because the thing is, DC does not have a deep bench. And so inevitably, as soon as it's like, oh, it's Superman and Batman, it would be like The Flash and Wonder Woman and Green Lantern. It's just like... They don't have... It's not like Marvel, where it could be, who are they going to meet? Is it the X-Men or Captain America or
an incredibly
Doctor Strange?
Bench.
No, but not one that people... Not one that people find interesting. There's loads of people that most people haven't heard of. So it's always got to be, oh, here's Batman again. And the whole idea of merging something which was meant to be a kind of like, you know, a satire on or a kind of an extrapolation or, you know, an attack on superhero mythology and just going, let's merge that with the superheroes that it was riffing on.
Yeah.
It just seemed like, I mean, I don't like merging universes anyway, and I really hope that Disney do not like fuck about now that they own every sort of showbiz property in the world.
The Avengers meet My Little Pony.
Yeah, it's just going... But I mean, I found it kind of like, it's not that it's executed particularly badly, but just like the whole concept, it's apparently they claim they debated for 6 months about whether to do this. And it was just like, I don't believe that. But I don't believe that this, oh, I don't know, anguishing about it. And it's just like.
But it's also like, it's like they're deliberately taking pleasure in rubbing people's noses in it, because they do this thing where. At the start, and I was reading it and I'd read some of the press, at the start they go, all of a sudden there's there's a lockdown in America, and there's kind of TV, there's people on TV going, actually, we're shutting down and stuff. And I was thinking, hold on, that's like the voice of the voice in
V for Vendetta. The voice of fate in V for Vendetta.
And it's like,
yeah.
What? So they're actually like going to more. Like, you know what?
How many ways can we piss off Alan
Moore? Yeah. And then halfway through, the Watchmen was famously laid out on a nine panel page. So, and every page in the comic was nine panels. Halfway through, they start doing this, and then halfway through, they kind of stop doing it, and it's like, what is that? You know, why are you doing that? And
then because you're in a different universe.
But then, they're not. They do it halfway through. Yeah. They do it while they're still in the universe, and then at the end, there's a kind of at the end of every Watchmen comic was a quote from a work of literature or a piece of film or stuff, and it was just a quote set up. And the quote in on the final panel of this one was from a poem called Ozymandias, but it's, and obviously there's a connection to one of the characters. But it's not the Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley that everybody knows, and which is a classic of literature. It's the other Ozymandias by Horace Smith, who apparently wrote it as part of a competition with Shelley. And then everyone's forgot that comic, that poem, because it's not very good. And they're kind of like,
where are you going with this analogy?
I hate it even more now. I mean, think what really grated with me was the kind of the slavish but completely tone deaf imitation of the panel grid and the tone of, you know, and the lettering for Rorschach's diary and the kind of pretentiousness that Moore could pull off. It was like bad karaoke.
Like, you know, there's a gag in Rorschach's diary. So Rorschach in the original speaks in is always writing stuff down in a notebook, and the notebook gets found at the end, and that's how the kind of truth gets out. But in this one, there's a little bit of writing in the top of one of the columns, one of the panels. Never write anything down. It's far too dangerous. Written in a notebook. Now, is that a joke? Because I don't think it is. I think it's just such a crappy, like, rip-off that they just did it that way without realising. Yeah.
Ian,
say
something nice about this.
Okay, so here's the thing. I think that the idea is a very, very good idea.
Okay.
So this idea, first of all, there's a thing of, should we have sequels to things? And I just don't know. If you don't like the sequel, just sort of ignore it. So, I mean, it doesn't bother me that Terminator 3 exists. You know what I mean? It doesn't take away from Terminator 2 any more than Terminator 2 would take away from Terminator 1. Aliens versus Predator is a fucking abomination, but it doesn't make any difference to me. Alien is still great if I watch it, and I can write all of that stuff off. We all have our own personal canon. You can close that off where you like. And I accept that right now, the way that this is looking artistically, this is not going to be in anyone's headcanon in 5 years' time. Obviously, they're going to stop with that beautiful moment of ambiguity, which is the final panel of The First Watchman. However, what is happening here is something that comics has been doing a lot of, because it's in a very unique place, and it's in a specifically a unique place because of what Watchmen did to the industry, which is that it used to be something that you left when you were children. And in the 80s, something changed. Yeah. You started getting works from Frank Miller, works from Alan Moore. Later on, you know, from people like Grant Morrison or Neil Gaiman or Warren Ellis, which meant that the art form grew up with us. I was a kid in the 80s. I read this book when I was about 8 years old. And comics grew up with me. So there was still enough intellectual and emotional
content. Let's not forget, the reason that Alan Moore originally is so pissed off with DC is because, according to Alan Moore, that's a big caveat, the contracts that him and Dave Gibbons signed meant that when the books and the comics went out of print, the rights all reverted to him. And Watchmen was the first thing that's never been out of, first comic that graphic novel that has never been out of print.
But the reason for that is because it was so successful.
Well, he thinks that they were personally... But then they wouldn't go back. They didn't do the deal.
That's the stuff that he says that I find Morrissey-level insane. Because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, every contract, the contracts that I have for my own book, is if this goes below a certain number of printing, the rights will revert back to you. That's what a book contract does. Yeah. Now, in his case... Yes, it was the first one, because it was the first one that never stopped selling for years. I mean, even, you know, now you look at The Watchmen, the trade paperback, will be one of DC's highest selling books. They didn't do it to conspire against Alan Moore. They kept on selling it because people kept on wanting to read it.
To be fair to him, though, his response is not, you bastards, you shouldn't have done that. His response is, you have successfully swindled me. Well done. But I'm never going to work for you again.
But I don't think they have swindled him at all. And in fact, that is certainly not what he was saying at the time. And that's the contract that he signed. But anyway, if we can go away from the contract bit, because I think the thing is, there's something artistically to be said for this, which is something very interesting that happens, specifically people my generation, a bit older, as you grow up with comics, that when they say something like, look at how cynical this is now, and the concept behind this, is really that the DC Comics superheroes have become so cynical, so corrupted because of the influence of books like Watchmen. Mm. This is a very, very interesting belly button to start investigating for me, because it doesn't just say something about what's happened to the comics industry. It also really is saying something about who you are as a reader, because they're the characters that you read when you were eight. And as you grow up and they change, the classic book for this is a book called Identity Crisis, which is, I think, quite good. It's hated by most sort of comics fans and features a rape scene against the elongated man's wife, which, you know, as a sentence tells you everything about where the superhero, you know, sort of fiction went. Asking questions about that through the medium of Watchmen is, I think, a very, very sensible thing to do. However, I will fully accept it is not working out here. And part of the reason for that is just he's not as good a writer.
If you were writing Doomsday Clock, I might be interested, because I like that idea. But there's nothing here that suggests anything else than gross cynicism.
This is really, you know, picking up Hamlet and saying, wouldn't it be great if you could say, gosh, well, that was only a flesh wound. I wonder what Claudius's next evil plan will be. Everybody gets up. And then his next evil plan is he's teamed up with Iago and Richard III and maybe Adolf Hitler and the Master and Lord Business from the Lego Movie. It's just pure intellectual mashup bullshit.
The comic site Bleeding Cool has dug out an interview they did with Alan Moore from 2010. Where he basically says, they said, why don't you take, well, you know, why just take the money? And he said, I don't wish to make money out of my characters being put through a lot of lame moves which can do nothing but discredit the original work.
Yeah.
And having read this, I can kind of see what he was thinking
about.
Well,
I've got good news for you, Matt, and for you particularly, Ian, because they're not just deciding to jam Dr. Manhattan and everybody else into the DC universe, they're also putting Promethea in as well. She's going to be popping up. Maybe she can go out drinking with Black Canary or something. Maybe she can become the new love interest for Robin. It's bullshit from top to bottom.
But I think if you cannot recognise that some characters exist in a self-contained world, like, that just seems so fundamentally
goes everything of the way that these sort of shared universes operate.
But
should always be break down the walls, play with them. All the toys are there. Play with them and see what works out. And ultimately, Watchmen itself is a product of that. He took Charlton characters. He wanted to use the originals. Yeah. That should have been Blue Beetle.
I don't think Alan Moore would ever take characters from late Victorian horror novels and put them together
crazy accusation.
That would be crass and offensive.
But he himself has shown that that's what is so good about the disposable nature of comics. And this is just a progression of that, which happens, I must admit, to not be done
but
very well.
The point is, what are comics really bad at? Endings, because theories have to go on and on and on. What has Watchmen got that most comics do not have? An absolutely fantastic ending. You should leave it there. That's my feeling. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Can I make one more point on that? Which is just that the ending is in your head. So there is an ending, for instance, to Batman. And that was written by Neil Gaiman several years ago. It's a two issues, which basically is inside Batman's head at the point that he dies. Now you take that, and that is in your head canon. That is the bit that you select. Comics goes on forever. It's up to you to select the endings from within it. And as long as that's the sort of quite relaxed approach you take to this stuff, you can afford to be a bit more, you know, chilled about it than all of us getting terribly upset.
That's a very generous take for you to do there, Ian.
I'm very generous when it comes to my own opinions.
And as a giant alien squid explodes over central London, that means our show is pretty much done. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Dorian and Ian from Romaniacs for coming on the show. Please do come on again. You can listen to them.
Thank you for having us.
Listen to them anytime you like. Every week, with top guests on Romaniacs, which comes out first thing on Friday mornings. So please go to the Apple Podcasts app and subscribe. And also subscribe to Big Mouth if you don't already. Remember, dear listener, if you've enjoyed this show, then you can enjoy our past episodes at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. And if you have a moment, please go on Apple Podcasts and give us a star rating and a review to spread the word. We're going to be back next week with more quality pop culture talk. Until then, from me, Ian, Dorian and Matt, thank you and goodbye.
Thanks.